Michael Waltrip has joined us on Sports Byline. The name of the book is In the Blink of an Eye, Dale Daytona and the Day That Changed Everything. I alluded before the break about growing up in Kentucky. Tell me about what it was like growing up in the Waltrip family.
Well, from the time I was on this earth, my brother, I was born, he was 16. So my mom and dad, the weekends that we had where mom and dad wanted to go somewhere, it amounted to throwing me in the back seat and us driving to the NASCAR races. So while I wasn't personally involved in Daryl's team, or I didn't get to hang around the garage because he had moved down south by the time I grew up, I always got to go to the races. And most of the time I sat in the grandstands with my mama and watched from up there. And that's how I just, you know, got to know everything about racing. And when I was a 12-year-old kid and I finally got a chance to drive a go-kart, I didn't know exactly how to drive the go-kart, but I knew the lines to take, and I knew how to set someone up for a pass. I learned all those things from watching, and so as a kid, I wanted to be like my brother. I admired him. I loved him. He was my hero, and I wanted to be just like him. So I watched every movie made, and I knew that if I had the chance to race one day, you know, I needed to know how to make those moves.
How did he feel about you? I mean, younger brothers always kind of get pushed aside. I know I did that with my brother.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, nowadays it seems like maybe the brothers are all trying to help each other more or something. But when I was a kid, you know, he was really into his own world, and he was really trying to race for championships and win races. By the time I was showing up at the races, I was just more of a, kind of like you said, just a pain in the neck, and I got treated that way. But That didn't make me love him any less or admire him any less. I just took that and figured that's the way things were. But I studied real closely everything he did. And when he would come to town, and I'd get to sit around at mom and dad's house and talk to him and listen to stories about racing. Those were the most special times for me when I was a kid.
One of the things that I know, Michael, that happens, and I think it's just a natural process in families, is that when you have one child that is successful, that becomes the measuring stick for the other child as well. Because of Daryl's success in racing, was that what the way your family measured you as far as the success or failure?
Probably so. And I had a pretty successful brother, 3 championships and 84 NASCAR wins in the Cup Series, so you know, I think that for a long time, my mom and dad just thought I was living a dream just to try, you know, that it would be just that, almost an impossible feat to ever wind up even making it to NASCAR, let alone winning in NASCAR. And so, and I don't, you know, I understand that. Heck, every kid I tell in the book, you know, I told my mom and dad I wanted to be a race car driver, and they're like, yeah, we know every kid in town does. They all want to be like your brother. And that's sort of the attitude of the way it went then. But I'm telling you, Ryan, if you're 12 and you want to be a race car driver, you might as well say, I want to go to the moon. You know, the chances of that happening are really slim. And sometimes a dad or a mom will want their kid to be a race car driver, you know, and they want to race through them, let them race and be a part of it. And that just wasn't the case at my house because mom and dad had already gone through all that with my brother.
You know as well as I do, and I use this analogy, to be honest with you, Michael, with pitchers. I always ask pitchers, do you remember the time when you went from being a thrower to being a pitcher? Because there is a difference. And I'm going to ask you a question and address it toward driving, and that is, do you remember the time where you went from being just a driver to being actually a racer?
Well, the first race I ever ran was a go-kart, and I was 12, and there was like 3 other kids in this race, and I'm pretty sure my go-kart was a lot better than theirs, and I just drove around them and drove off. and so I thought I was racing, but mainly I was just driving, like you said. But then the first night I drove a stock car, I got into the most amazing match against this kid that he was my age or maybe a little older, but he had been racing for years in stock cars, and he just knew more about driving a car than I did. He passed me, and I passed him back, and we just had this great battle. And I remember when that was over, it was the first time I really thought, well, darn, that was a race. Me and him had a real race there. That was awesome. My car wasn't any better than his. It's the same, and we just raced, and I loved that feeling. So it happened the first night in a stock car, and then as you progress forward and the competition gets tougher and tougher, there's a big short track NASCAR race in Indianapolis, Indiana, at the Indianapolis Raceway Park. It's a Kroger 200, and it was a race that a lot of the NASCAR Cup drivers had won and raced in and had success in, and all the great NASCAR Nationwide Series drivers had won it. And I went up to Indy one night and won that race in 1989. And so winning that night, I passed Mark Martin with just a handful of laps to go. Dale Earnhardt was in the race. But winning that night, that legitimized me, in my mind, as a guy that could race with anybody on any given track because of the toughness of that event. So I know 0 for 462 sounds like I struggled for a long time. But while I was losing those official cup races in a row, I was winning some nationwide races. I won the All-Star race in 1996. I led races. I accomplished just about everything but pulling into victory lane in cup. And so it wasn't like I was this hack for 462 races. I was competitive and close, but what I needed was someone to help me manage my career and help coach me into a better place than I had gotten mentally, and that's exactly what Dale was able to do for me.
Let's fast forward to February 18th, 2001, the Daytona 500. Tell me a little bit about the feeling you had toward the end of that race. When did you sense that you had something special that particular day?
Well, it was with the red flag. There was a red flag with about 30 to go. They had a huge crash, and Tony Stewart flipped over, and there's probably 15 or 20 cars in the crash. And prior to the race that day, Friday before the 500 on Sunday, Dale had explained to me how me, Dale Jr., and Dale, the three of us, were going to win that race. We were going to work together, and we were going to win that race. And I remember thinking, whatever you say, boss, I like the way that sounds. I've never even had a teammate before, let alone Dale Earnhardt telling me we were going to work together to win. And but I also remember thinking that sounded maybe a little bit unrealistic to think that out of the 43 cars in the race that day that these three cars would be at the front at the end working together in order to try to win. I remember thinking, that sounds good, man, but I don't know. There's a lot of stuff's going to go on between the green and the checkered, and I'm thinking that might be a bit of a stretch. And then with 30 to go, they had this huge crash, and we came to a stop under the red flag, and the first three cars in line, 1, 2, 3, me, Dale, and Dale Jr., just like he said it would be. And then all of a sudden, I said, wow, you know, that's amazing that he called this event, he called this scenario. And now racing together and working together became a reality. I mean, it was even... My dumb butt even understood it then because it was, you know, it was real. There was three of us, and we only had to beat about 15, not 40, and that's exactly what we went out and was able to accomplish. But it was because of a plan and Dale telling me, you know, you race your rear end off and be around at the end, and I was able to do just that, and that put me in a position to be able to win.
One of the things that I've always loved, Michael, about sports in general is the emotional aspect of it. And, of course, the emotion being high when you win or being low when you lose. And you went through an emotional whiplash, and you talk about it in the book, about where you win, and you're waiting at the end, and you're waiting, and you're waiting. Tell me a little bit more about that moment at the end after you'd taken the checkered flag and just waiting, not knowing what had happened behind you.
Well, I mean, I was just oblivious to everything. I was in this shell. Like I said, Victory Lane was a closed environment, and obviously there was TV interviews to do, and there was pictures to be taken, and no one in Victory Lane really had any idea of the seriousness of Dale's crash. So we were just, you know, living it up, loving it, thinking that everything was perfect, thinking that. You know, finally, everything in my little world was right, and then Ken Schrader came to Victory Lane and just grabbed me, and he said, "Man, it's not good." And I remember telling him, "You know what? It's not that bad that I won, is it?" And he said, "No, Dale's hurt. He's not good." And that set into motion me getting really concerned and trying to figure out what he meant by that. But it was still another 20, 30 minutes before I finally was told that Dale had died.
Also, I would assume, and I think anybody that saw the accident looked at it and said, well, this isn't very bad. You know, we've seen cars flip in NASCAR races and do other things. Was that one of the hardest things for most people around NASCAR racing to try to come to grasp with? It wasn't anything real serious. Why did this happen?
Well, I think you know, anytime a car flips and barrel rolls and all that, then it's dissipating energy. The energy is being flung off or slowly wound down. And in the case of Dale's crash, it was an abrupt stop. The thing veered into the wall and just literally slid to a stop within, you know, a few hundred feet of where it hit. And so when you look closely at it, which I have done now, and looking at the tape, you can just, it broke the rear end housing. The left rear tire just flung off the car, and you could see how hard the impact was. And not only was he hitting the wall, he had another car there driving into the wall with him. So it's not surprising to me at all, looking at it and understanding, you know, we're running close to 200 miles an hour and understanding the violence of that crash because of the sudden stop. So while it didn't look like one of the most spectacular crashes we've ever seen in NASCAR, you could certainly see as an insider how hard it hit and how quickly it stopped, which is the worst thing that could happen.
We have just a couple of minutes left, but I was very interested in something you've written in the book. You say, one guy defined me and continues to do so both professionally and personally. His direction made me a winner. He's never stopped guiding me. Glad you're still with me, Dale. And I'm just wondering, is there something in that relationship between the two of you that is so meaningful that other people won't understand?
Yeah, I don't think people really, you know, there wasn't many people that realized that he helped me so much, and he was always there for me to put confidence in me and to help me believe in myself too. And you know, he fixed me up with my wife, and so our relationship was probably deeper than a lot of people ever really knew or realized. But, you know, the thing that meant the most to me was the way that he made people, he wanted people around him to be better. You know, he wanted to help you be a better person than you ever thought you might could be yourself. And he wanted to do that by giving you what you need, whether it's direction or advice or companionship. And so I like that about him as a friend, and I love that about him as a car owner, because as a car owner, you know, he was really into making sure his cars were the best so that his drivers could go out and do the job. And the folks that worked at Dale Earnhardt Incorporated, they knew Dale didn't have to have a team. He had a team because he wanted a team, and they just really wanted to build his cars better than everybody else. And so part of him that I think is with me today more than anything is just my desire to build winning cars and my people's around me's desire to help me accomplish that. And that all comes from the way that I watched Dale walk around his shop and how he inspired his people to be maybe more than they ever thought they might be.
I want to thank you very much for writing this book, but also talking as humanly as you did about that relationship. I think many times people look upon two men and their friendship and also maybe a professional relationship, not in the way that you've talked about it. It's a wonderful book, Michael, and I appreciate you taking the time. And I'll just tell people that at the front of the book it says, "For my heroes, if not for Daryl, I would never have started dreaming. If not for Richard, I might still be dreaming. If not for Dale, I don't believe my dreams would ever have come true." Thank you very much for writing this book and for sharing your thoughts on it, Michael.
Well, I really appreciate it. I know you reach a lot of people, not only in this country, but across the world, to our troops overseas and all the folks that help keep us safe here so we can race cars and do all the things we love to do. I just want to say thank you. And hopefully the book is inspirational to folks to read and understand that adversity is a part of life, and maybe overcoming it isn't quite as simple as you think it is. But when you do, it certainly makes it all worthwhile.
Please come back and join me anytime here on Sports Byline. Take care, Michael.
Thank you.
Two-time winner of the Daytona 500, Michael Waltrip, with us. We'll take a break as we continue with more of you in Sports Byline.